Welcome to The Laws of Style, featuring conversations on creativity, fashion, and the law from the leading edge of our economy and culture. Hosted by noted fashion lawyer, Douglas Hand.
Hello, and welcome to The Laws of Style. I'm your host, Douglas Hand. And for this episode, I'm joined by the founder and creative director of the environmentally sustainable brand, Angel Chang, none other than Angel Chang herself. Angel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Douglas, for having me.
Explain to the listeners what drove you to found your brand and explain what it is.
Okay. Well, my line, it's called Angel Chang. It's a zero carbon women's wear collection made seed to button entirely by hand without electricity by indigenous artisans in the mountains of rural China. And it's made without any plastics or chemicals or fossil fuels. It's made just using what's on the land. So natural plant dyes, heritage organic cotton, and it's hand sewn. Even the labels are made from silk, created by silkworms raised in the homes of these villagers. So there's not, even in the thread is cotton, so there's no polyester in it. It's 100% biodegradable. And we're climate neutral certified. So we cover our shipping from there to the US with offsets. So that's my line, kind of in a brief summary. And what inspired
seed,
me-
Seed to button, I have to ask. I mean, that is, that's evocative of the whole, both life cycle of it, but also how natural it is. Have you considered trademarking that?
Seed to button? I don't know. Well, you're a lawyer. So in business school, the one business school class I did take, it was called business plan for PhDs. Basically, business plan for non-business people. They said that instead of trademarking it, you'll constantly be innovated by others. So just keep innovating.
That's wise advice for a lot of the IP protections that protect may not be the right word for what they do to the fashion industry. But you brought up education, and maybe let's start there just so that we get a little bit of background on you. Can you tell us about your education and, you know, how it led to design, how it led to being at larger companies like Donna Karan?
Yeah, so I studied art history in school. I always wanted to be a fashion designer from when I was 16 years old. I could sew clothes. I started sewing when I was 9 years old, but I grew up in Indiana, so fashion really didn't exist where I lived. And like opening up the pages of Vogue just felt like a whole nother world. I thought, oh my God, who are these people? Who dresses like that? Because I didn't see people like that. So yeah, nobody really took me seriously that I wanted to be a designer. But then I sent a letter to Anna Sui when I was 16. She was my favorite designer at the time. And she said, okay, if you want to be a designer, you have to come to New York and do an internship, get industry experience. So I applied to Barnard College, the women's college up at Columbia in New York City. And I did my undergrad there in art history, and that first, like 2 weeks before school started, I went to Anna Sui's store and she saw me and she remembered the letter and she offered me an internship right there. So I interned with her for like 2 years. And then I took draping design courses and illustration courses at Parsons, at FIT, and at St. Martin's in London. You know, my dad was a professor, so he wouldn't let me go to fashion school. He's like, you got to go to a real school. So I studied art history. And then when I graduated, I was accepted into the MA program at Columbia in New York. And I was like, no, I need to take a year off because I still wanted to be a designer. But the course was for those becoming art historians and curators. So I took a year off and I went and did an apprenticeship with Victor and Rolf. Back then it was just the two of them and an assistant and another apprentice. So it's just the five of us in like this little house, and it was amazing. And then after that, I came back, did my MA course in art history. But then for my thesis, I wrote about the anti-American sentiment. This is after 9/11, so there's a lot of international anti-American sentiment. Those who were protesting against, like, McDonald's or American soap, like in other countries. But what I realized is that they would be wearing blue jeans, or they just couldn't give up the clothing. They couldn't give up the soft culture of the US. I thought that was very intriguing. And so my MA thesis was about how you had these big three designers at the time, Ralph Lauren, Calvin Klein, and Donna Karan, and how they all marketed this aspect of American lifestyle, like a being like American, like cool. Donna Karan was about the feminist woman, woman in the corporate office, and then you had Calvin Klein, who was about like youth and independence, and then Ralph Lauren was about this like New England kind of like waspy kind of look that was totally fabricated. but it was just this ideal of what American culture could be like, and you could wear it. And so,
No, really, the articulation of those archetypes by those big three was really prevalent, and still is today, with maybe, Calvin and Donna having fallen off a little bit just since they left their brands. But yeah, wow, that's bad. I would love to read that. So continue. What was the thesis
Well,
ultimately?
the question about education is really interesting because my undergrad thesis was on Victor and Rolf, and I was studying art criticism and French art criticism or French art philosophy. I don't know, it was like Foucault and Descartes, and applying that to Victor and Rolf's collection. And then they invited me for an apprenticeship. And then with Donna Karan, before I graduated, I started working there in the design department. So I was on the women's wear design team, assisting the senior creative director, Donna's right hand, doing inspiration, fabric development, creative direction, and also designing accessories and whatever the three main designers were designing, I was a part of.
Wow. Well, so let's flash forward to maybe your aha moment where on a trip into China, you discovered some of the artisans that you currently work with. Can you just unpack, how did that even happen? Was it deliberate, or was it some sort of vacation where you decided I'm going to get off the grid and I'm going to go visit these places? How did it come about?
Yeah, so at Donna Karan, part of my job was inspiring Donna and the design team. Inspiring. It's like basically buying vintage clothing and then using it as inspiration. Every fashion house was doing that then. I probably still do it now. But in my mind, I thought, okay, if we're taking inspiration from like a World War II bomber jacket, then we're designing for that lifestyle from that period. It's not modern today. So in 2007, 2008, I started my own line. My line, which was still Angel Chang, and it was taking innovative fabrics and smart materials that were being developed at MIT Media Lab, and in the army, and then incorporating those into fashion. So it was like jackets that were self-heating or fabrics that change color with UV light from the sun, or prints that disappeared with body heat, for example, thermochromic inks. So after a couple years of that, then the recession hit, and I realized, oh my gosh, if I really want to design for the future, I have to learn how things were designed in the past, and not like World War II, but like in the like way, way, way past. So when I went to China, usually there are these everywhere I go around the world. Like I'm always at a museum with a sketchbook, looking at the traditional costumes. So it's just part of what like a designer does for inspiration and research. But this particular time, I was in Shanghai, and I saw all of these traditional costumes from all these ethnic minorities across the country. And what was different this time was that they had the year that it was made, and the ones that I loved were made in the 1990s, and it said the exact province and the exact village where it came from. And so in my mind, I thought, okay, like Adonikaran, what we would do is we would, take an old costume and then we would send the fabric to Italy and develop it. And like 6 months would go by and finally we'd have our fabric. So in my mind, I thought, oh, why don't I just go directly to the artisans because it'll be faster. Like, it'll be, like we won't have to recreate
They're
it.
making it already.
They're making it already, exactly. So that weekend, I hopped on a plane, went down to those villages in Guizhou province. Never been there before. I couldn't speak Chinese, so I had a translator and then a driver. And we just drove like deep into like 4 hours, 9 hours into these villages, like deep in the mountains in Guizhou province.
Wow, fascinating. And so you get there. And you've got this interpreter as a sidekick. I mean, what was the reaction? And what was really ultimately the aha moment for you that related to the Angel Chang brand?
Well, at that time, it was all about cultural preservation. So the interpreter, he was not an ethnic minority. But what he told me was he was one of the very few people locally who knew where to find these textiles, and that's because he had just led the collectors of the British Museum to these grandmothers and to these villages. And he said, these fabrics, they're buying up the fabrics, and you should do the same too, because these fabrics are going to disappear in the next 5 to 10 years because the younger generation isn't continuing the craft. And I thought that was really sad. Well, first, I thought it was really sad. And then the second was, as a designer, like, I thought, why can't we find a way to keep it going? And he said, well, no matter how much you pay the younger people here, they don't want to weave the fabric. They want to move to the big cities or become migrant workers in those big factories so that they can send money home. And this is, they want to assimilate into the dominant culture because they think it's theirs is not as sophisticated, and this is just the eroding of their traditional culture. So I thought that was really sad. But every year or every 6 months, like I would like go back and go deep into these villages. And it took me 2 years before I could finally speak Chinese like fluently. And so on my first trip that I went alone without a driver, without an interpreter, translator, I asked this teenage girl, she's like 15 or 16, and her grandmother had pulled out all this fabric that she hadn't shown anyone in like 20 years. And her grandkids like looking at it like all intrigued, and they're like, well, why do you want to see it? And I asked the girl, look, if I paid you money to learn how to weave this, would you do it? And she's like, yeah, of course. Like, I'll open up a workshop and I'll make fabric from you. So it was the complete opposite of what the translator had told me. And I only got this by speaking directly with the villagers in their native tongue.
Wow. Well, and that problem is not just in China. It's certainly here in the United States. It's you speak to any Italian craftsperson or French craftsperson, and they would say the same thing, that the youth is really kind of turning its back on those traditional ways of making, whether it is shoes or accessories or fabric. And certainly it left the U.S.'s shores many a couple of generations ago, and there are very few facilities that make anything. I think denim is one of the few things that is still made here in the U.S. and not in the same sort of seed to gene fashion that that your brand espouses. So how did that lead to so amazing? You're there, you're actually engaging with a local artisan, not only the artisan, but the artisan's daughter or granddaughter, and how did that become a business? And how do you deal with the realities of that being a difficult business to manage? Because unlike being able to place an order with a factory, in Bangladesh or in Turkey or Peru, you're dealing with a less sophisticated party, and candidly, a party that, may have other things going on where they're just not going to get to it that week.
Yeah, they're my priority I was not their priority, that's for sure. Their priority is farming. For them, like when they go to work in the morning, they're going out to the rice fields and they're growing their food because they need that to survive. And then they come back and they put it in these like wooden houses, and that's like their bank deposit, right? So they put the rice and grain in there. So it was a totally different way of life. I'd been working in the industry for so long, first at Donna Karan, and then I was at Chloé, at C by Chloé in Paris, and then briefly at Lululemon in Vancouver. And so, I was used to getting fabrics any quantity, any time of year, and any color that I wanted. But here in these villages, everything was, no, that's not possible, or no, it's not the right season, or it was like, we can't do that, or it's just gonna take too long. And I couldn't, it was so frustrating. It was just, yeah, between that and the language and just being in like a foreign country. I mean, my parents immigrated from China, but I never stepped foot in China by myself. Yeah, it was just a whole nother culture for me. So I realized that I had to forget everything I had learned in the fashion industry and start from scratch and be like an intern again. It was frustrating because all of my friends were becoming like design directors and creative directors, and here I was like pissed off because I was in nature. I sort of like stepped off of the career ladder and I had to start from scratch again. So I would hang out with the grandmothers, and then I would just observe how they made fabric, and then they would teach me, and then I'd have to gain their trust. And each conversation lasted like 4 hours. And so I really learned how to talk to the elderly, which is a whole nother skill because money will not motivate them, so you got to like figure out like what will motivate them, and usually it's about like how beautiful their fabrics are, or like, oh, I can see your personality in this, and like it was just really funny. We don't, because I never learned that in New York, to really think about what motivates human when you take that money element out of it.
Right. Well, that brings up, and I mean, so many directions to go from here, but I want to stay on that thread, and you'll pardon the pun. It's not like you can tell the old grandmother, you're going to be fabulously wealthy, or I'm going to be able to pay you this on a monthly basis, that motivates them. And in fact, they kind of look at you with sadness in their own eyes, thinking, is that really what you're all about? Capitalize, making us a capitalist society is not going to work because we're very happy, even though you may think we're living in circumstances that you yourself wouldn't live in, but we're quite happy to live this way. I mean, was there any of that sort of cultural tension as you approached it from a very Western perspective, and they had their own perspective as a small group?
Yeah, I would think, China modernized a lot in the last 30 years. So there was one time when you could work as much or as little as you could, but you just still only made $50 a month. That was like communism back then. I don't know if that's what the older generation like grew up with. I don't know if that just kind of instilled like a lack of, I don't know. But anyhow, then things boomed up like when China opened up, because like those people who made $50 like a month suddenly were like millionaires because they like cashed in. So that was like all what was happening while I was working in these villages. Now the young generation, they're very entrepreneurial because they grew up with China opening up to the world and just having their economy boom. I mean, when I got there, I went there in 2010, and the US was kind of like now, like it was still kind of in this recession. It was really depressing. And then I go to a China where there's this generation that's never seen economic decline. They've only seen double-digit growth every year. And everyone's like, ah, party, party, party. It was really sh like shocking because it was polar opposite of what was happening in New York. So I would say the young generation, they are motivated by money because that's why they were leaving the villages, because there are no jobs in the villages. They have to go to the factories on the coast, like in Shenzhen and Guangdong, and they stay there like for 1 year and they leave their kids behind. So they send money back and then their grandparents take care of the kids. And so you had this huge problem of 60 million kids being left behind in the Chinese villages across China. And that's like, I think, one in six children in China, like, we're growing up like that. So when you don't grow up with your parents, you become more depressed, and it's an issue that they were dealing with. And so the young, they leave. The old ones, they are not motivated because they can make everything they need to survive, right? There's kind of like a confidence. It's interesting because when I was there, it's like there's a kind of like a certainty and confidence that like a farmer has when they walk down the street with their like water buffalo or with their like bushel of whatever. And they're just that just must be what it feels like to like walk on land that like you know how to work with, that your ancestors like grew up on. You know, I think in the US, like, we don't feel that, right? Because we're such a new country.
Well, and we're so far removed from everything that we engage with. I mean, starting with what we eat, but what we wear and the lens of technology that we encounter most of life through. I think about driving upstate in my electric vehicle, right? And what would I do if it broke down? Like, I'd be useless. I'd call somebody, right? And if my phone broke, what would I do? I mean, you really don't have that sense of self-assurance of the person who, if their water buffalo sprains an ankle, they tape it up or they do whatever they do. Far be it from me to know what they do, but they're so close to the actual issue that they can solve it. And we've
Yeah, and
removed
like,
ourselves.
exactly. Like, one of the issues was when the electricity went out, because electricity would go out every time it rained, which was like every 2 days. And I would be the only one freaking out because all the villagers already knew how to live without it. And so their life didn't change at all. They just, instead of turning on the light, they just like sat outside, or they were still like plowing their rice paddies with the water buffalo just like pushing it. You know, it wasn't like some tractor or anything. And like, I don't know, it just, when you they would make everything they needed to survive, including their home. So they would grow the trees when they were young, and then when they were 30, the tree would be big enough for them to cut down and use that wood to build their home. So, and if they wanted to add on another room, they would have to plant trees and wait another at least 7 years before those trees were big enough that they could like cut them down and use them. So there is this real understanding of nature and the laws and nature cycles of nature. You know, I would go in and I'd be like, oh, I, you know, really want to, oh, for example, like I wanted silk, or I wanted cotton, or I wanted something. And they're like, oh, you'll have to grow it. I'm like, grow it? Like, you don't just have it? They're like, no, we don't have it, but you can just grow it and then just wait 6 months for it to grow, and then like you'll have it. You want silkworms? Go find a mulberry tree and then wait until April for those leaves to grow so you can feed them to the worms, and then you can raise your silkworms, and then by July you'll have the silk thread to make your fabric, you know. So everything was planned like a year in advance. They just and if they hadn't grown it like or grown it 6 months ago, you just didn't have it. And there was this acceptance that we didn't grow it, we just don't have it, so you can't make it. That's it. It wasn't like, oh, let's go online and find where in the world we can find it and have it shipped overnight. It wasn't any of that. You know, it would have taken like 3 weeks to ship anything, even like a box of pencils. So you really had to rely on your knowledge of the land and what you could make out of it.
So for the brand, how do you scale it? under those conditions? And I say that assuming you want to scale it. I mean, what are your plans for the brand? Is it as far flung as I'm scaling it so that we can go public someday, or it works now and it works when, you know, when the crops are good and I get enough product that I can make product from, but in years that it won't, maybe I'll skip a season. How do you balance the sort of old ways and their lack of alignment with current consumers who want now, want on sale, want it fast? How do you do that?
So I always get the question about scale, and scale means different things to different people. So what's your definition of it?
Well, I guess I would say that revenues are increasing, that profitability is on a trajectory to increase. So I'm looking at it from a very financial investor-centric perspective.
Yeah, so it's scaling. Is it like tripling or quadruple? You know, like how, like what is, it's not like exponential growth. Do you only get that with technology or, you know, pharmaceuticals? With fashion, you know, it's a slow growth process. And so we've never had a problem with scale in terms of production. And in fact, one time I asked the farmer, and the farmer and the weaver, she's the same person. She said, okay, let's make a deal. She's like, I don't want to work in the factories in Shenzhen. I find it really constricting. I feel more free here at home in my mountain village. So can you guarantee me a certain amount of fabric that you'll buy from me? I was like, sure. Like, how much? Like 200? Like, how is 200 meters of fabric a month? And she said, well, you know, 100 I can do myself. That's easy. 200 is more difficult because it requires more people. But if you order 1,000 meters a month, I can get my family involved and we can all make it together and it's easier. So it's like, oh, okay. So the villagers are actually asking me to scale up. And so it's not a problem for them. It's more about how can I get more demand on the US side, get more customers buying and placing orders.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, fashion industry, and particularly apparel production, second most wasteful industry on the planet, only to oil and gas. I mean, the global consumer of fashion products has a thirst for now, new, fast fashion, lots of turnover, and the way in which these things are manufactured is somewhat unholy in terms of, you know, what workers are paid, and even the materials that are used, because they are often not natural, or if they're natural, you know, the way in which pesticides and other elements were used in raising them is problematic from an environmental perspective. So you sit at a wonderful juncture of being able to say, look, this is natural cotton. It's made by artisans. I mean, it hits a lot of notes for those consumers that are aware of this problem and want to solve it through their own purchasing behavior. So how do you get that out there?
How do I get my collection out there?
And I guess the word out there, but the fact that your collection is, in fact, you know, I mean, look, I could probably point to three posts by Zara or H&M espousing, you know, their environmental stewardship. And you and I both know that 98% of their line has none of that. But, you know, they'll point to one or two things. 100% of your line is that. And there's a genuineness to that, which is rare in the industry. So how do you get that word out?
Yeah, there's a lot of greenwashing in the fashion industry. You know, what's funny is that that greenwashing has only been happening for the past couple years. Before then, you know, I've been working in sustainable design, whatever you want to call it, I've been working in the villages since 2010, 2012. So it's been a really long time. And I didn't see myself as a sustainable designer really until someone called me that in 2015. Okay, now we're like 9 years later. But then I couldn't share my vision or my story about sustainability, working with nature, blah, blah, blah. I couldn't talk about climate change in my, as it relates to my brand, because it scared people away. And that was in 2019, the year before the pandemic started. And I remember that because my PR person was like, oh, you know, like tone down the climate stuff. You know, you're going to scare people away. And some people don't believe in it. And I was like, no, it's really important. And so, but then, so then I kind of focused on the beauty of the fabrics, like pretty model. And then, oh, you discover it's all natural and it's zero carbon, whatever. Fast forward, oh, just like a year later during the pandemic, suddenly people were so concerned and about, or so aware of climate change, and they were experiencing all this extreme weather that was a result of it. And suddenly, yeah, the dialogue just blew up. And it was quite liberating because I felt like I didn't have to lie to people anymore about my motivations. I could just totally be honest. And, you know, there are now all of these climate activists online who are also, you know, targeting these brands and educating people about what is sustainability, what is greenwashing, da 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 da. So you didn't have that awareness just a few years ago. So I feel like I don't need to educate people as much as I was trying to before, and I can focus more on the design because now there's a whole community that is working to bring awareness.
And so it sounds like, you know, from a demand side, you're optimistic about the future, and you feel that from your position of strength on this issue relative to virtually every other brand out there, that consumers are hearing it, or do you still feel that greenwashing creates so much noise that it is confusing to the average consumer?
Well, it's definitely confusing, but then if you like, okay, I was a REMAKE fellow this past year. REMAKE is this nonprofit organization that raises awareness about sustainability and garment labor practices in the fashion industry. And there are all of these women who are also Remake ambassadors, and they are all online and they're just like posting about Zara did this and Nike did this and get Levi's to change this, and they're just like posting, posting, reposting, reposting. And it's just the amount of awareness for like Gen Z is insane. You know, even my 13-year-old niece knows not to buy Shein. And so yeah, there's huge progress in that, and I think the truth comes out. Truth comes out. I know.
Well, yes. I mean, I certainly hope so. Apropos of that, so obviously there are certain certifications that one can obtain, and probably the most powerful, I think, to U.S. consumers is B Labs B Corp certification. That being said, it's a real heavy lift for a small organization to go through that process, which is largely ESG based, you know, getting a certain score based on legitimate and quantifiable answers that are documented that a business can provide. Have you ever thought about obtaining B Lab certification? Or, as I sort of explained it, and maybe you've experienced it, it's just such a megillah to apply and fill it out that you're kind of like, look, I consumers know. And I happen to be one of those that, you know, that has a brand that doesn't need to have an outside nonprofit certifying my practices.
Yeah, B Corp, you know, 5 years ago, I was interested in B Corp, and there were zero fashion companies that were B Corp certified. And it seemed like nobody knew what it was. So, and customers didn't care. So I was like, okay, I guess I'm not applying for it, even though I care about it. And then now I have the reminders, email reminders every month being like, you have to fill in your application. But it's just, I don't know. I haven't done B Corp because I don't have people asking me for it, I guess. The clients who wear my clothes, they're luxury consumers. So most of them are older than 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, and just because of the price point. And they care about the story. They love knowing the artisan's name. And they love how it feels on their body. And that's what they value. They're not, no client has ever asked me, are you B Corp certified? Like,
Well, that's a great point from the front lines.
that said, I am
Yeah.
climate neutral certified. And the reason for that is because in the beginning, I was telling journalists about my design process, and they kept, you know, trying to find holes. Like, whoa, so with zero carbon at the location, but what about flying it from China to the US? And so I got the climate neutral certification so that I can offset my carbon emissions for the whole operation, including my office in the US, and all of the shipping and all that. And so then those offsets every year we can choose where it goes. And so I happen to choose the Amazon this year.
All of which would give you high marks on the ESG test that that B Labs requires. But you're absolutely right. It's largely for brands. It's viewed as a bit of a marketing certification. And if you don't need it, and continue to maintain the same practices, then you know, then that's great as well. So let's talk about the line. And you know, we'll post some images. For our viewers, but you know, tell us about the price point. Tell us about seasonality, if there is seasonality. Some of the you know, sort of anchor products that you offer, and what materials you make them out of.
Okay, so I spent, let's see here. The collection that's out now on my website, it started out from a grant from the Smithsonian Institution, and it was part of a show. And so they helped give me an artist grant to develop the prototypes and the first samples. And that's I my initial and motive was to create clothing like it had been made hundreds of years ago before the invention of electricity. So we followed traditional craftsmanship exactly as their ancestors had done, like no shortcuts, no chemical dyes, no nothing like that. So not even like metal buttons or plastic buttons or no zippers. And at the end of that journey, after a few months, we had our prototypes done, and I realized that we had made everything in a 30-mile radius without electricity, without any chemicals. Oh, at a point we didn't even have running water, so it was just fresh mountain water that was trickling down, and it was all plant dyes. We made it with a zero carbon footprint, and I was really surprised and shocked because, you know, there's all this talk about well, there is some talk about sustainability, and I've been designing in the fashion industry for so long, but how is it that I never knew that clothing was always made in a in a sustainable way historically? Like, why was that such a huge surprise to me? And then I realized it's because we've lost that knowledge in the past 100, 200 years since the Industrial Revolution. And it's since the Industrial Revolution when the fashion industry was created, and fashion, as we know it today, sartorial fashion, has always been made in a polluting way that's harmful for garment workers. It's inherently like that. It's just like built on that system, right? First it was like cotton, what is it? This would like open up a whole can of worms, because it's like slavery in the American South, growing cotton for the British textile mills, you know, like that thing. And then you go to children who are working in factories. So then in England they had to like ban child labor, but then you had women in there working instead. And then, you know, there were all of these poor working conditions there. Then then you had chemical dyes were invented in at that time too, in the late 19th century. Anyway, so you just add all of it together and you see that it's not just about changing one thing, it's about changing the entire system, the entire foundation that this fashion industry has been built up on. However, if you look at the way traditional clothing was made, if you ever go into a museum and you look at the ethnic costumes, you will see those are all made from natural dyes and they were all made by hand from natural materials and plants. And those were made all, like you could say, they were all zero carbon, they're all sustainable. So I forgot your question earlier before I went on this tangent.
No, it's good because I wanted to get a lot of this out there. And you know, the thing that that is also insidious about the industry of fashion is that it really is designed around telling you that what you just purchased is now out of fashion. So, you know, you have all of the negative elements of production, but then you also have them speeding up rapidly and creating waste because what is made, as soon as it's sold 3 months later, it's the next season, and you're trying to sell the consumer something else entirely. And basically, you know, convincing them that what they bought is obsolete, not because it doesn't function, not because it doesn't still wear, not because it has a hole in it, but because it's out of fashion, which is such a mind fuck, really, when you get right down to it.
It's planned obsolescence, and those trends are artificial, right? And nature isn't saying, oh, every 3 weeks you need like a new shirt or a new color. Like, no, it's marketed to you so that you feel insecure that you don't have that. You want to have the aspirational life that you see in the ad, and you want to live that person, be that person, and you can be that person by buying this brand's handbag or perfume or whatever. But then 3 months later you realize, oh, it's out of fashion. Now you have to get this thing and that thing. And I don't know, people say, oh, brands shouldn't do this, but I think we also need to, in meditation, because I meditate a lot, there are these things called external locus of control and internal locus of control. And external is when you have the outside world affecting your mood. You're always in this reactionary state, right? So if you wake up and you're in a good mood and suddenly someone else is screaming and now you're in a bad mood. And so you're always dependent on the outside world to influence how you feel. Whereas we need to develop our internal locus of control, which is we have to always be in like this happy, positive state that we're in, or just like build it and strengthen it so that we can go out into the world and not have these other forces affect us, these other outside forces, meaning like the news, which is always like about some catastrophe. So like bad news, bad media, negative people, negative things, this chaos, whatever that's happening on the streets or in the world, that are not related to what we're doing right now. So we brands are, they're marketing stuff, they're just trying to make money, but also we need to build the strength of the public and the consumers to avoid that. So could be like, don't read fashion magazines, or like limit your time on your phone, or someone at Facebook told me to turn my screen black and white so it would keep me from looking at my phone. That helps a lot. We need to build up those skills so we have more internal control.
Well, to be provocative, I mean, I know my answer to this, but I'm interested in yours. How do you respond to the claims from some that sustainable fashion is something most consumers can't afford, and that in effect, it's a snobbery, and it's classist to blame someone for buying something from Shein or from H&M? To be in fashion, and you know they'd love to have one of your garments or a Stella McCartney garment, or but they simply can't afford them.
That's an interesting question because my clothes aren't for everyone. It's positioned for a luxury consumer who has a specific is at a specific income level because she can buy it and wear it, and it's at the same price point as the other brands that she finds in her closet, like Loro Piana or Gabriela Hearst or Brunello Cucinelli, like that's what she wears. So I designed it to fit that price point. And it links with how I'm able to pay the artisans, how much they I'm able to pay the artisans properly and make the clothing entirely by hand. So there are no shortcuts in the costing. It just follows like normal fashion costing, and then this is the client who buys it, right? So by definition, luxury is that like not everyone has it, right? It's just like more rare, and it's the rarity that makes it attractive for people. Now, the thing about democratizing fashion and fast fashion is, yeah, like maybe in the beginning, fast fashion like did it allowed people to buy clothes at a certain price point when they couldn't afford it. But what's happening now is that Americans are buying, what's the number? I think 68 pieces of clothing per year, which is three times as much clothing as our grandparents had, and we throw most of it away. So we're consuming too much. We're not wearing it, and it's ending up in landfills, like in Ghana. So it can't even be sold in those secondary markets because the quality is so bad.
Do you think it's because our fundamental relationship with clothes has changed? So, back to your relationship with the artisans and, the way that they live, which maybe, in certain communities is the way people were living 400 or 500 years ago, where much like that farmer who would know how to handle if his oxen went down or, if your clothes ripped, you mended them. And everybody could mend. And there was a jacket. You would there was one jacket for the family. And if you were going out in the rain, you took the jacket, as opposed to everybody having their own multicolored selections of jackets. Is that part of it? And if so, when did that happen? Was it the Industrial Revolution? Was it some sort of marketing genius that happened in the 1960s? Genius being in quotes, obviously.
Oh, yeah. So that happened with mass production. So, mass production, Industrial Revolution, mechanizing things. Once the machine got involved and could start producing things, like, so I'll just talk about like the artisans I work with. It takes for each item, like a shirt dress, a shirt, whatever, it takes 5 to 6 months to make from when we plant the seed to when we finally sew the label on it, the buttons and the buttonholes and everything. 5 to 6 months, the entire process for one piece of clothing. Their jackets, if they put embroidery on top of it, it could take 2 years to finish that jacket. Okay. Now imagine you spend 2 years making your own jacket at home. You grew that cotton on the land. You watered it every day. Like imagine like taking care of plants like every day, right? You're watering it. Then like every part of that process you made yourself with your very own hands. And this is not an easy process. It's just like really labor intensive, but you're doing it out of love because you're making it for your kids, right? And so you're following this process, and after 2 years, you're not gonna throw that jacket away after a few months. You're gonna keep wearing it or have your kid keep wearing it. Or, 5 years, 10 years, what happens is that indigo jacket, it may have started out, they make it purple, but then after 5 years, the purple disappears and it becomes more blue, like dark blue. And then, as they're out in the fields wearing this jacket, because of the sun and the sun chemistry on the indigo, the fabric starts to turn black. And then, after 10 years of that, then the color starts to fade away and the black disappears. And now you start to see the white yarns underneath. But they're not all white yarns. There's like this zigzag, like chevron, kind of like a black and white pattern, because when you initially wove it, you had this chevron pattern in there, and it took 10 years of wearing it every day and having the sun beat down on it before the fading happened, where it could finally reveal that chevron. And so you've got this jacket that just gets more and more beautiful over time, and it has a life of its own. And so, yeah, you're not going to throw that away. It just increases its value over time. And then let's say like 20 years go by and you're like, no longer need it, no longer mend it, maybe like you've gained weight, doesn't fit, then you can cut it up and turn it into a blanket or like a pillow or a table spread or a bedspread.
Yeah,
But
it
don't throw it away.
reminds me
You will
of
not throw it away.
the sale of immediately distressed jeans, right? Where they've got the rips and the, we're so far removed from the actual life in the clothes and the stories that the clothes carry with them. Well, so let's pivot a little bit because I want to get a sense of your personal style. So can you for me just name three style icons that have impacted either your design or your own personal dressing?
Oh my gosh. I saw your question and I was thinking about that and my mind was totally blank because
I'm good. I finally got a zinger in there for you.
yeah, you know why? Because like in the normal fashion design process, yeah, like you've got pictures of your muse and it's always like, I don't know, like some style icon from the 60s or the 70s, Brigitte Bardot, Lauren Hutton, whomever. But the thing is, I've been thinking about the future. Like I'm designing for the future, and that style icon, she hasn't been born yet. She hasn't been created. So there, I can't put a face or a body to that style icon that inspires me. I have to envision it in my mind, because and I have to create it. And you know what the weird thing is that I actually never, like, as designers, we often do this, like we think of our muse like in our head and then we design for that person. But because design and sales are so separate, like I used to design just up until the runway and then the sales team would take over, and so I would never see who would wear my designs when I was working for a brand. And then when I launched this line in 2020, all through the pandemic, I didn't know who was buying my clothes because they were all online or I would speak to them on the phone. But because of the pandemic, like I never saw them in person. And so last year was the first time I actually saw my clients face to face, had lunch with them or they came to see me. And the weird thing is, they were the exact image I had in my mind, like that I had visualized when I was designing, but they were like even better. They're like even more stylish than who I thought it would be. And they're just like even more amazing. And they were like women that I aspire to be like in 10 years. So yeah, I couldn't come up with an answer for your style
No,
icon
you crushed
question.
that. That is the best answer I think I've ever had to that question. So I'll ask you another hackneyed one, which maybe will be a zinger to you, but I'll get a similarly brilliant answer. What for you is the difference between fashion and style?
Oh, that's easy. Okay, so fashion, it's temporary. And as soon as you think you have it, you no longer have it, that trend. Once you think you're on trend, a new trend has appeared. Whereas style is passed down generation to generation. It doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter where you come from, your socioeconomic background. When I went into these villages, Guizhou Province was the poorest province in China at the time. When we think of China, we think of like, like all these people with all like billionaires, whatever. There are two Chinas. There's the money China, and there is like the super poor farmer China, which people don't hear about. And even Chinese people from the cities wouldn't come with me to the villages because they're like, oh my God, that's too scary. But I was like, no, it's fine, it's totally safe. They were super duper poor. But when I saw these grandmothers, they looked so stylish. Like they had their traditional costume on, they had all of the right colors on. It was like indigo with a flash of like fluorescent green or fluorescent orange, and then their long hair was like wrapped in this like bun, but like in this like bunch Shignon thing that like I've never seen before with like these sticks in it and these like metal things. And then they had this like baby carrier with like all this other embroidery, and they made all these clothes themselves. And then they had like these pleated skirts that they pleated themselves on a steamer. And then sometimes they stacked the two or three skirts on top of each other. And everyone looked like this because in these villages, everyone wears the same uniform. So it identifies them with that particular village. So I was like, okay, well, that's really weird because they're so poor, they don't have any money, and yet they are more stylish than the women I see in the big cities like Beijing and Shanghai. Like they know how to color coordinate everything. And even the grandfathers, they're wearing like dark purple with violet with a shade of brown. It was like all tonal. And what I realized is that it's because they're wearing all natural dyes, and in nature, natural dyes do not clash. Everything works together.
Wow.
Then I went up to the Tibetan Plateau up in the northwest of China in Gansu, and I worked with a workshop and these Tibetans who are like yak herders to design a training program and design some sweaters and knits. And the same thing there, they were the poorest group of Tibetans in this region, yet they looked so amazing. Like they had like this long braided hair, and they had like their traditional jackets with the long these long robes, and then this like beautiful orange coral looking jewelry and turquoise. And it was just insane. And so I asked someone, how is it that they have so much style? And they told me that's indigenous knowledge, right? It's just like knowledge that's passed down from the elders to the younger people on how to dress and how to look at colors and how to look at things aesthetically. And so style is that. It doesn't matter how much money you have. It's a skill set that you develop with your eyes and your culture.
Well, unisex fashion or gender fluid fashion. I mean, you've described your customer as your muse and your woman. I guess I wonder, do you think in the future there would be menswear? And if so, would it be menswear or would it be simply men and women picking and choosing from your garments because they have no gender expression to them?
Yeah, well, I call myself a women's wear designer because that was the training I received. So in the industry, you choose women's track or men's track or knitwear or accessories. So I don't know how to design for men. I don't know what men want. I know men only wear three shirts, like either the button down or the t-shirt or the polo shirt. I know that. And then there are variations of all those, but I wouldn't know like the fit, like what is comfortable, like how much to take in or out at the shoulders, the sleeves. Like I don't know those numbers and those measurements. Whereas for women, like I do, because it's been ingrained in me. Now, my collection has a lot of male clients. That's what's really funny because like they'll buy the shirt, they'll buy the shirt or they'll buy the pants, and it just look, well, I would say this, okay. So I had these pants that were traditional men's pants in the villages, and then I changed the waistband so they sat a little higher so that women could wear them. And then suddenly, here when I did my pop-ups last year, like in Palm Beach and the Hamptons, these men would try it on and they're like, oh, these are awesome. And so then they started buying them, then posting them on Instagram, and then their friends bought them. And then these men were like, oh, we love your story so much. Do you have anything else for men? And I was like, well, I do have this one shirt. But it's a secret because I don't know how it will fit on guys. And so it's like a secret link. I give them the website link, and then they bought it, and then they buy it for like their friends. And yeah, so like I have this male following, and but it's women's clothing.
Yeah,
Oh,
no, I get, look, there is a physical reality to most dimensions. I mean, obviously everybody's shaped differently, but the male body and the female body do have, some commonalities within their own gender. But and the industry kind of girds you to one or the other, although that's an evolving thing. Well, Angel, this has been really wonderful. We're out of time, but I really thank you for coming on and speaking to our listeners, and really appreciate the work that you're doing. So, with that, I will see you next time.
All right. Thank you so much, Douglas. It was great chatting with you.
All
Thanks
right.
a lot for the interview.
Bye now.
Have a great day. Bye.
You've been listening to The Laws of Style with Douglas Hand. For more information, go to our website at www.hballp.com. And you can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Hand of the Law. Thank you for tuning in, and stay stylish.